This is Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back to Ottawa Now. Thanks for tuning in and spending some time with us. We continue to follow the finance minister getting grilled on Parliament Hill this afternoon as he's before the MPs on the House of Commons Finance Committee. It has been an absolute grilling, to say the least, and a lot of remarkable things that are coming to light this afternoon. So we'll talk about that later coming up. Justin Ling has been covering this. We'll delve into it a bit more with him, but I think it was good to hear from Duff Conacher on that because they have been going on and on about this, saying we need more transparency. Again, kind of ridiculous on two fronts. One, that this government build itself on transparency, on being open and honest. This is the opposite of that. This is the opposite of transparency. When you have two people that have ties to this giant charity that gets a big government contract, sole sourced, and they don't recuse themselves. And then it comes to light that the finance minister just cut a check today because, oops, he forgot about $41,000 in trip expenses from two trips back in 2017. Just pretty astounding. And on the other front, I mean, the fact that he's the finance minister, and isn't he supposed to be somebody who's good on staying on top of records? That's very disconcerting to hear. 412 right now. I want to talk about this survey that was done by the Ontario Health Coalition about long-term care homes and the staffing levels. We're not going to back down on this. The military report in Ontario about the state of long-term care was disgusting. It was jaw-dropping. And it is not acceptable. And so we're going to continue on this topic because I think it's so sad to hear all of the people that work in this industry coming on the show, all of the experts, all of the advocates, PSWs themselves, coming on the show and saying this has long been an issue and we have long been sounding the alarm about it and nothing's been done. So we're going to stay on top of this. 95% of Ontario long-term care home staff are reporting staffing shortages. That is according to this new staffing survey done by the Ontario Health Coalition. The organization went out and it asked people, is staffing worse, better, or is it the same since prior to COVID-19? 63% of staff said it's worse. 28% said it's pretty much the same. Only 7% said staffing levels were better. And more than 50 staff surveyed reported that there is not enough time to feed, hydrate, and help residents properly. Joining me right now, I have Natalie Mira on the line, Executive Director of the Ontario Health Coalition. Thank you for coming back on.
Thanks for having me.
What is your reaction to this survey and the results?
Well, I have to say that when I was reading through the surveys, they made me cry. I mean, there's just no way around it. I've been doing this for 20 years, and I've worked closely advocating for improved care and long-term care for 20 years, and we just have never seen anything like this. I mean, it was a crisis before COVID-19, but now, you know, the staff are reporting deaths of residents due to dehydration. They're reporting not enough time, as you said, to feed, not enough time to bathe, not enough time to wash, not enough time to clean, just every activity of daily living. You know, they say that there's no time for emotional support. Their reactions were, you could see it these were written surveys. You could see it in their responses. They were upset, really upset. They talked about it being heartbreaking, about the sadness and the loneliness of residents and not being able to even have one-on-one time with them, that all care is rushed. You know, the list of what they can't do, we asked, what care can you not provide because of the staffing shortages? And the list just, it's every type of basic care that keeps people alive and healthy. It's unacceptable.
Understaffing at a long-term care home takes on a whole new meaning. And, you know, in other industries or in other jobs, you know, perhaps at a restaurant, you know, understaffing might result in the food being burnt or cooked poorly. We're talking about human beings here. Understaffing here can result in people not being changed, not being fed, getting ill, getting bed sores. I mean, it's an atrocity. It is unacceptable. I'm just wondering why this is happening. I'm reading from the report, the majority of homes report empty shift lines, meaning that vacancies have not been filled. Why is that? Why are there vacancies that haven't been filled, and why are there so many vacancies?
Well, this was the case before COVID-19, but it's much worse now. And so what happened during COVID-19 is that people left. They were afraid. 8,000 staff and residents, more than 8,000 staff and residents have been infected by COVID-19 just in the last, you know, through the first wave of the pandemic in the last 4 months, and more than 1,900 have died. And so the, you know, staff have left because they're afraid or they don't have childcare. They've been injured. There's a lot of injury in that sector, a lot of violence. And so people have left and there's no way to recruit people into the homes. The workloads are crushing. There's very serious safety issues. The wages are poor and have fallen behind significantly. The acuity, that's the complexity and the heaviness of the care of the residents, has increased. And so, there was a major recruitment problem prior to COVID-19. Now the situation is just unspeakable, and it requires a policy response. I mean, the homes cannot be left on their own to sort this out. They couldn't sort it out before COVID-19. They have way less capacity now to sort it out. And a second wave is coming. I mean, all of the indicators are that there is always a second wave in pandemics. And so, hopefully it won't come, but chances are it will. And there's just no resilience there. The residents have lost resilience. They've lost weight. They have declined, many of them, from depression and isolation and so on. It's just unspeakably sad. And there are not enough staff now to provide the care in the existing homes. I mean, we heard from homes that had lost 60 of 150 staff. 60.
Wow.
And they can't find staff to replace them. So everyone, virtually everywhere, is working short-staffed. And some homes have been decimated. And, of course, during the pandemic, the first wave, staff had to choose one home to work in, which is right because COVID was being spread by people going from home to home to home. But that meant that the ones with worse wages and working conditions, particularly the for-profits who generally have worse wages and working conditions, lost many more staff and were decimated. And so the wages have to come up. They need better working conditions. There need to be enough of them. They need to be safe. They need proper PPE to keep them safe. So
do they not have proper PPE? Because, Premier was on about that, saying that's not acceptable. We have to get them the personal protective equipment. That is critical in controlling outbreaks and preparing for a second wave. Do they not have the PPE? What are you hearing?
No, they don't. They're given surgical masks. I mean, the same resident, when they're transferred to hospital, is being treated by nurses and physicians in full PPE, right? In a long-term care home, you might have surgical masks. The directives from the government say that staff can be required to wear the same PPE, so the same surgical mask, until visibly soiled. So from resident to resident to resident, the same mask, the same PPE, so the same gown, et cetera. No, that was an unacceptable level of infection control before COVID-19. It's completely unacceptable now. So no, they don't. N95 masks are, needed, absolutely needed at minimum. If you're treating people with COVID-19, there need to be enough of them. You can't be required. Under the directives right now, staff can be required to work if they test positive but are asymptomatic. So the whole world knows the role of asymptomatic carriers in transmitting COVID-19. That is an unacceptable level of infection control. It continues in healthcare across the board. The levels of PPE are not safe and the staff need them, and it has not been sorted out yet.
Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the show. We'll check back in on this. Thank you, Natalie.
Thank you very much.
Natalie Mira, Executive Director of the Ontario Health Coalition.
Can I go where you go?
You're listening to Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back to the show. All right, we got lots to come in the back half of the show if you're just joining us. A quarter of all public servants are taking this special paid leave known as 699 leave. If you're in the public service, you know what it is. It's for circumstances outside of anyone's control, and more people are taking it. What does that mean? Debbie Davio, who represents public servants, will join us coming up, and we'll get into that. It's a pay code that means it is approved for employees who are unable to report for work because something has, you know, gone awry. It's separate from vacation or sick pay. More and more people are taking it. So we'll get into that coming up. Also, you've heard stories before about COVID-19, people being on a ventilator, but what about people that survive, that are hit hard by COVID-19, but are now living with the after effects of it? A team of Ottawa researchers are looking into the long-term consequences of COVID-19. What does it do to the mind? What does it do to the body? And we'll speak with somebody in Ottawa who is still trying to adjust to life after COVID-19. It is a long journey to recovery. Also, Marit Stiles, Ontario's NDP education critic, will join us. We just heard from the Ottawa-Carleton District School Board trustee that the drop-dead date to figure out what type of classroom or what type of learning will happen in the fall is August 4th. So the Zone 8 trustee said August 4th, that is when we will find out, and then we will communicate to Ottawa-Carleton District School Board parents as soon as we can. It could be up to a week later. But they're trying to hammer that out, and they had a meeting last night until, sounded like midnight, 12:30. Marit Stiles will join us coming up. She's been highly critical of the premier and the province's approach to this. Plus, more on the disastrous WE committee hearing for the finance minister. Justin Ling, a freelance journalist who is covering it, will stop by at 5:20. But right now, an update to a tragic story that we've been covering out of Quebec. Sûreté de Québec police have provided an update on that horrific case of homicide. They say that the body of Martin Carpentier and his two daughters, Romy and Nora, were already dead. Those people were already dead by the time a Quebec Amber Alert was triggered for the missing family. They went out for ice cream, and then we don't know what happened. But according to police spokesperson Guy Lapointe, he says they can confirm that they did discover the body of the father this week.
Since last night, we've had the confirmation of the identity of the body that was found at the end of the day on Monday as being Martin Carpentier's body. Obviously, for us, this puts an end to the criminal investigation because the investigation demonstrates that there was nobody else who was involved in this crime. So for us, the criminal investigation is over, and now the coroner's office will take over.
It's a very tragic but confusing case. What happened? Well, it all began with a car accident on July 8th. Based on what police have told us, the car crash didn't seem like it was deliberate. He was apparently trying to gain control of the vehicle. He was unsuccessful. The car crashed. And looking back at it, they say after that, the father broke into a trailer about 1.5 kilometers away from the site of the crash. They believe he was the only person who went inside. His daughters were with him at the time. And then the children's bodies were found less than a kilometer away. Again, here's Guy Lapointe with the police.
The suspect kills him with a blunt object. I'm not going to go into greater detail on the circumstances of the death, so I don't think that it's necessary. But I just want to tell you that for us it's clear that it's a double murder and that the girls were killed at that time with a blunt object. Then the suspect continues on, and now we're at 5.5 kilometers from the car accident, which is where we found the body of Martin Carpentier. All of these events that I've just shared with you, the four main moments in the sequence of events for us, happened very quickly.
We don't understand why. Police said prior to the crash there was no indication that this was going to happen. They went out for ice cream. They found an ice cream cone inside the car. And they said up until the car crash, his behavior was considered normal. No one, according to police from his family, said they were concerned he was a threat to his daughters, but they're not speculating on what happened. It is 4:30. Quick break for the news. You're listening to News Talk 580, CFRA.
You're listening to Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back to Ottawa Now. It is 4:38. Thank you for spending some time with us on the show. You know, COVID-19 has really taken its toll on the mental health of many people. And I'm wondering if that's the case of the public servant. When I saw this story from CBC that more than a quarter of all federal public servants were granted paid time off during the first 11 weeks of the COVID-19 pandemic. So there's a code, and if you work for the federal public service, you probably already know it, 699. It's the other leave with pay provision. It's approved at the discretion of management when employees are unable to go to work. It's for reasons beyond their control. It's not the same as a sick day or a vacation day. It's something else. Between March 15th and May 31st of this year, 76,804 employees took that leave. That's 27% of federal public workers. Joining me right now to chat about this, Debbie Davio is on the line, president of the Professional Institute of the Public Service of Canada. Hi, Debbie. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
What do you make of that number?
You know, that's not a surprise at all. I mean, basically what that says is that 25% of the public service had to use code 699 at one mm-hmm. point. But when you really sort of work out the numbers, what it works out to is about 5% of the total salary. So, you know, there was a 5% reduction in the productivity of the public service as a result of COVID-19. And I think that's really quite remarkable, really fantastic that they were able to shift on a dime, go home, work from their dining rooms with kids running around them, and only, you know, have a reduced capacity of 5%.
Can you just explain for the parents or other people listening right now that don't work for the federal public service, what is 699 for? What is it supposed to be used for?
It's a leave code that has always been in our collective agreement called leave with pay for other reasons. Of course, it is rarely used because most leave is fully conceived. You know, we know what sick leave we have and what vacation we have and what family related leave we have and what kind of leave to go to appointments or whatever. This is for other things that weren't conceived. And of course, the pandemic would be one of those things. And suddenly you had an entire public service that had to be sent home and try to be set up to work from home. And, you know, initially we didn't have the IT infrastructure for people to be able to connect. So only critical services could do their jobs. And that would all contribute to the 25% of public servants who had to use 699 occasionally. And, you know, there was a number of functions that government sort of deprioritized while it beefed up its services in other areas. So, for example, at Canada Revenue Agency, where they ended up delivering the CERB benefit, as well as putting together a number of others, the auditors at Canada Revenue Agency, who normally do tax audits, were sort of in a stand-down mode so that while people were dealing with the pandemic, they weren't also dealing with outstanding taxes or tax audits. And so since that function couldn't be done, some people were on 699, but people volunteered in the thousands to go and do other work, like man the phone lines during, you know, the big peak times for people applying for the CERB.
But if we have a huge chunk of people that are employees, that are parents, and listen, I completely understand that, that puts them in such a difficult position when the kids were out of school for them to be working. I can see why somebody might need a day off, but with such uncertainty looming about the fall, are you concerned that this is going to become such a necessity that it'll become more of a regular occurrence because parents are going to be grappling with this during times when the kids are in a hybrid mode? Some days they're at school, some days they're not.
Important to note that 699 wasn't only used for people who had problem with childcare, although they would be some percentage of the people using it. It was also used for people who had to quarantine as a function of their job. So, for example, we have nurses working in northern and remote communities who had to quarantine between shifts. It was used for people who became ill. In some cases, people who couldn't get back to the country in time and got stuck somewhere abroad. And so there was many uses for that code, not just family related, but where it relates to family related, we've been in some pretty deep discussions with the employer about how they're going to manage going into the fall, given that, you know, right across the country, the scenario is a little different about children returning to school. You know, for the moment, our members with families are often working into the night or very early in the morning to try to make up hours and putting in as much as they need. But a clear solution for this problem, you know, from both a work perspective and an economic perspective, would be safe, reliable childcare spots that workers could access during the crisis and as the crisis continues. And at the moment, that's just not the case. So, you know, government needs to turn its mind to ensuring that those places are available. And just like any Canadian, public servants are going to be looking to their leadership to help them navigate this. And we're in discussions as a union with the employer to try to, you know, close some of the gaps that may exist now with our collective agreements or other agreements between the employer and its employees. Those, you know, gaps have, you know, certainly arisen as a result of the pandemic. And so we need to enter into, you know, reasonable and fair discussions about how to close those gaps. And 699 is certainly on the list of items that are under discussion.
As you've likely seen, Aaron Woodrick of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation is quoted as saying it's a big number, and in future, he thinks that federal employees should be granted reduced pay or leave for a fixed amount of time or perhaps laid off so they could be qualified for the CERB. What is your response to that?
The response that I can say publicly on radio?
Well, your pick. We do have a 7-second delay, so I'll leave it up to you.
The question here isn't why were public servants protected when private sector employees weren't. The question should be, why aren't private sector companies supporting their employees to weather the storm? I mean, we're advocating for how employers should support their employees, and certainly the federal government as the largest employer should lead the way when it comes to the gamut of issues we've had to deal with. And, you know, on the flip side, if they're not providing 699, what happens? Do you all of a sudden have a bunch of people, mostly women, on employment insurance or on the CERB because they can't work full time? Or do you instead, you know, work with employees to find ways that they can contribute effectively and productively throughout the pandemic? And, you know, I think we're doing a pretty good job of that.
Debbie Davio, good to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Debbie Davio, president of the Professional Institute of the Public Service of Canada. 'Cause I can't hide it, I can't
hide it. You're listening to Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back to Ottawa Now, 4:52. So in Ontario today, we have 165 new cases of COVID-19, no new deaths being reported, and a lot of attention being paid to the fact that more than half of the new cases recorded in our province were under age 40. In our region, in Ottawa, there are 33 new cases. It is not just Ontario that is seeing increases. Our neighbors in Quebec, they've seen the uptick. Alberta, British Columbia. And some news developing out of Saskatchewan this afternoon. That province is now reporting the highest single-day increase they've seen since the pandemic began. 60 new cases have been reported in Saskatchewan today. Here's the premier of Saskatchewan, Scott Moe. He says he's relating it, connecting it, to community testing.
These case numbers are very concerning, but they are not entirely unexpected. This large number of cases was detected as a result of the aggressive testing and the contact tracing that the Saskatchewan Health Authority has been doing in a number of Hutterite communities in the province. And that work is ongoing. So it's possible that we may see similar case numbers in other communities in the very near future.
In British Columbia, dozens of people apparently went to this drum circle on a beach. There's a video circulating out there. It's getting a lot of feedback, a lot of criticism. It's a big group of people, most of them not wearing masks, dancing around. Pretty shocking after Dr. Bonnie Henry was saying over the weekend, we've got to get a grip on this. This large crowd not physically distancing comes after that she was warning residents need to limit their contacts. She said that a lot of the new cases were linked to bars and private parties and said before where contact tracers had to track down three or four people, now they're having to trace 20 or 30 contacts for every single person. Any person that has a confirmed case of COVID-19. In Calgary, Calgary is making masks mandatory as of August 1st. That city has seen a rise in cases, and the city council actually just voted in favor of that bylaw today. Mayor Nahed Nenshi was saying that this is rooted in health and scientific advice. Tom Sampson is Calgary's chief of emergency management. And we got a clip of him here.
This is about talking to Calgarians that there's a bylaw in place that requires you to wear a mask. Can you help us out? And it also involves giving our peace officers some masks to give out.
Meantime, in Manitoba, they're looking at moving into phase 4 on Saturday. If that's approved in Manitoba, they'd have indoor gatherings that could go up to 75 people. Outdoor gatherings from 100 right now to 250. And they'd also lift the isolation period for the rest of the country. Right now in Ontario, if you want to go to Manitoba, unless you're in one particular region, which is close to the border, you have to isolate for 14 days. They may lift that. It's 4:56. Well, you know, a lot of businesses are getting creative about how to operate during COVID-19, including one axe-throwing business here in Ottawa. Joining me right now, I have Carrie Mower on the line, the co-owner of Lumberjacks. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Christy. How are you?
I would imagine that axe-throwing right now would be kind of a therapeutic experience, a way of getting all your frustration and anxiety out.
Yeah, I think it's always been good for that.
So how have you been adapting?
We've done a number of things. When we first closed, we have quite a few regular throwers that come in for league. And so we immediately started building these sort of home or cottage units. And we started to build them so that we could deliver them and have our customers that like to throw a lot be able to put them up in sort of rural backyards or up at the cottage, kind of like an IKEA setup. If you had a drill, you could put one together in about 10 minutes.
Really? And how did that go?
Yeah, it was great. We had we sold 12 to 15 of those units, and we had a lot of people who would buy them as leading up to sort of Canada Day and Father's Day as an activity to do.
Well, there's a lot of drinking outside on Canada Day, Carrie. Was that a concern at all in your mind? Are these people going to be doing with these axe throwing kits?
Well, safety is always paramount.
Of course.
And so at Lumberjacks, we've always got a coach with our patrons at all times. The one thing that we've noticed is as soon as someone picks up an axe, it's sort of inherent that, you know, that you have to take certain precautions and people really treat it with a lot of respect.
I would hope so. The alarm bells go off. There's danger present. I need to be on top of my game.
This is all true.
Okay, so you've been doing that. And how about now that we're into phase 3? What does business look like now?
Well, for phase 2, we took advantage of the opportunity to go outside at our city center location. So we used our parking lot. And we have a commercial kitchen that's attached to our space called The Kitchen. So we started serving food and drinks out on the patio, and we have a mobile unit that we were planning to take to a lot of outdoor festivals. And given those aren't going to happen, we put that unit up out in the parking lot, and we've been having some league nights and some various activities out on that patio. So for the last couple of weeks, that's been keeping us busy for phase 2. And then for phase 3, we were able to open inside, so that sort of helped us if most people do want to be outside throwing, but at least if the weather's inclement or if it's been too hot, you can now come inside. So we just opened that up this weekend, and we had a manageable number of reservations. They're really small groups. We're limiting things to 2 to 6 people in the lane, whereas we used to have sort of 10 to 12. So it's much smaller groups. We're seeing a lot of date nights, people who've been cooped up for a long time who want to get out and do something, but also our space lends itself to social distancing and really being able to put people in their own spot and do something fun and unique, but certainly do it in following all the post-COVID guidelines.
Financially speaking, after such a grueling shutdown, that must have been tough. Are you seeing a bit of a rebound, or because of the limitations right now, not quite yet?
We had a great weekend. It gave us a lot of promise. I think we're hopeful that that there will be enough demand to pay our bills and to pay for our staff. We've been able to get all of our staff who are willing and able to work. They've all got shifts through the weekend. We've got a regular schedule. We're open 7 days a week now. We're doing some small axe throwing seminars. So I would say we're cautiously optimistic after the opening weekend.
Well, happy to hear it. We wish you the best of luck, Carrie. Thanks for stopping by. Be careful out there.
Thanks, Christy. Appreciate it.
Axe throwing, I've never gone. That is Carrie Mower, co-owner of Lumberjacks, talking about business now that we're into stage 3. You're listening to News Talk 580 CFRA. I'm Christy Cameron.